QST, QST, QST. This is Tom Fry, KF6Q, on the Big Bear Amateur Radio Club repeater, Tech Tuesday at 1900 hours, every Tuesday, conditions permitting. We wish to thank the Big Bear Amateur Radio Club for the use of the repeater, and as we do this every Tuesday, we appreciate that their use of this repeater. Boy, well, I messed that up, didn't I? Anyway, tonight's topic, we will be talking about field day preparation, safety in those preparations and things like that. We are going to forego the roll call tonight as I am currently mobile. So anyway, we're going to jump right into the DX report here with Mike. And Mike, WB6CLZ, are you out there? What's our DX and sunspot conditions?
Hey, good evening, Tom, and the Tech Tuesday Net. This is WB6CLZ. Well, things have been kind of up and down. We've had an M-class solar flare go off early this morning, and really, I don't think it's hit us yet. I don't think we've had any ill effects on the HF bands. 10 meters today was open, just kind of double hop and multi and single hop skip. Not much of anything, just United States type stuff, no real DX. But we've had sunspot count, let's see, right now Space Weather is reporting a sunspot number of 67, which is a little lower than what it's been the last week. We've been up in the hundreds, had even one day it was up around 150, so things are picking up a little bit. I haven't really had time to really get in and pound the bands and work DX, but I have been listening. I always enjoy that. I heard Israel the other day, a couple days ago. I heard Russia. I heard Sweden. A lot of the Baltic countries, a couple of Baltic countries, and Lithuania. Yeah, that was the one of them, and I don't remember the other one. But, yeah, so things are picking up. Things are looking good. I would expect before too awful long, maybe during field day, things will be open and, you know, back to where everything is good. And with low power, you'll be able to work the world. So that's about it on the DX report. Tom, why don't you see if anybody else has had any good luck with DX, KF6Q, and the Tech Tuesday Net, WB6CLZ.
Okay, Mike, appreciate that. Yeah, real quick, also on those solar flares, now that's something that takes the particles actually from that. Take a while to reach us? Is that, I'm just going to throw something out there, isn't that a few days it takes?
It is, and if they're reporting right now that we've got a speed of the solar wind is picking up. It's 475.9 kilometers per second, which is pretty fast, although it gets a lot faster than that. But it's very dense right now. We've got 11.6 protons per centimeter cubed. So I think we're seeing the effects of that in the sensors out there in deep space.
Okay, Roger that. You wouldn't have that in miles per hour, would you, for those of us who don't live on the metric system?
Oh, I could find it somewhere, but as you know, I'm not the mathematician you are. No, I can work that out, though, Tom.
No need. Anyway, it's moving this way and going pretty quick, so. All right, good deal. Well, is there anybody else out there would like to join in and share their DX experiences over the last week or actually whatever, please come back to KF6Q.
WK6F up here in High Desert, Felix.
All righty. Go ahead, Phelan.
Every week, my dog just sneaking. I want to say there's some side of skin it has, but during the week I've made contacts into Italy. And South Zealand. WK6F on 17 meters.
Okay, roger that. Appreciate that info. Yeah, you're having a little trouble hitting the repeater, and it's kind of in and out there, but I do appreciate that input. I always love to hear that. Anybody else out there with any DX reports or any activity this week, please come back to KF6Q and Tech Tuesday.
KF6U, KE5, NWI, Houston, Texas. Good evening to you, Tom. We just had a QSO with a group in Matlock, England, and we also are regularly talking with Australia, and we are regularly talking with Japan. We enjoy the Echo Link because we don't have any promulgation issues, and I've talked to almost all the way around the world. I've had some issues making contact in China, but I have made a contact in China, so to speak, but I've gone from the United States to Australia to New Zealand to Okinawa, into Russia, Germany, France, England, and back Iceland, and back to the United States again, all on Echolink. And it's been a very interesting opportunity. But in any case, that's my report, Tom, and thank you very much for the opportunity. KF6U, KE5 in WI, Houston, Texas.
Okay, appreciate that from Texas. Yeah, Kilo Foxtrot 6 Quebec here. And you know what? That is one of the good things about Echolink. When the actual propagation itself tends to go away, we can still talk around the world. So very good. Very good thing there, and appreciate your input this evening. So, is there anybody else out there with any input for DX or any DX work they've done? Please come back to KF6Q.
Well, not a DX report there, but I thought I'd check in late if I might there, Tom, there. AF6ZJ over here in Rosebud. Good evening to you.
Oh, hey, guy in Rosemond. Hey, that's almost far enough. I can't throw rocks that far, so it's got to be DX, right? Appreciate you checking in. We went foregone the check-in roster this evening as we started the net on the road here a little bit, now destinated. Oh, wait a minute. I was told that's not a true word. It's a ham word, though. Anyway, good to have you out there, guy. So I think we've kind of got all the DX reports out there we're going to get. I don't know if Clint's out there already, K6LCS in Harupa Valley. Clint, are you with us this evening? All right, K6LCS seems to be a little bit tied up as this is a little earlier than he's normally in there, but we will hopefully hear from him in a little bit there. So. Well, anyway, Mike, we're going to do safety, and I guess, you know what, one of the things here, let's just talk about generators for a startup there. We're going to have everybody who's working out there, mobile or portable, if you don't have solar or batteries, you're working off a generator. As a registered, certified, downright, down-to-earth electrician, what can you tell us, go into some detail about grounding a portable generator. What's up with that? What can you do, and what makes it safer that way? And, you know, just anything that you've done in the past, pipes, round rods, you name it. Mike, I'm going to turn that over to you while I switch radios. KF6Q on Tech Tuesday.
Hey, Tom, KF6Q, WB6CLZ. Switch radios, and if you get a chance, push that email and send me that email we've been talking about, too, if you get a chance. Okay, well, portable generators. Well, I guess anybody that has been to field day before, anybody that has used a portable generator kind of has knowledge of the basic type stuff. One thing that we want to point out, and a lot of people don't realize this, that a portable generator, that's 117 to 240 volts AC, and that'll kill you just as dead as house current will. So, I mean, it's something that we have to be very careful with. We observe all the standard safety observations with generators that we normally would with an AC system in your own home. As far as grounding the generators, I'm not sure what we will be able to do at field day because it's the Bear Mountain site, and I'm not sure if we would be able to drive a ground rod. It's generally not done. Generally, the generators are grounded at the generator, and the cord would be grounded. But if we did have a cold water, if we did have a ground rod available, naturally we would run the ground to that also for extra safety. The way that we kind of get around that is to take the place of a ground. We would use a ground fault interrupter, a GFI. Most of you are familiar with those. You have them in your bathrooms, your garages. You have any outdoor outlet, that's in modern times been installed in the last 10 or 15 years has a ground fault circuit interrupter. I'm going to reset. That's a pretty important device at field day. That will make up for, what it does is it sets the current coming in and on the hot and the current going out on the neutral. And there is a current sensor in the device that will shut everything down if it's less than 5 milliamps differential. So a very important device there. Tom, I'm going to send it back to you and see if you've switched radios yet. KF6Q, WB6CLZ, Tech Tuesday.
Yeah, Mike, probably going to switch radios again after this, but at least I'm on the portable now. So we can carry on there. Well, that's good. And actually, Mike, just as a question, and not just picking on our setup there, say if you had a chain link fence, just something that's a whole lot of metal like that, semi-planted into the ground here and there, would that actually just suffice for a ground, temporary ground?
Well, I use a chain link fence as an RF ground, and I suppose that would be better than nothing. I mean, you're making contact with the ground. You've got posts in it. You've got a lot of cross-sectional area. I would think that it would be better than not having any driven ground rod or ground element at all.
Okay, roger that. Stand by one quick second here. I'll just kind of get arranged here just for a second. Stay. All right. Well, that's good. Yeah, I know that sometimes a large mass of steel tends to act as a ground even in itself, and this is what we found on construction sites and things like that. So, well, anyway, good deal. Probably another topic, as we have many this evening, will be as we expand out on that. But before we do, is there anybody out there with any questions on that or grounding or anything they've done in the past with a generator or out there mobile like that? Please come back to Mike or myself, KF6Q.
IQA has a question.
Ah, Kelly, go ahead. Yeah, KI6IQA, KF6Q. Go ahead.
Would a wrought iron fence that's embedded into a big concrete retaining wall count as a good source of ground temporarily?
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to take that one, and then I'll hand it over to Mike to see if he's got anything to add. Typically, from my experience, we've done a lot of metal framing, and we'll go into a concrete tilt-up structure, wood overhead, concrete under us, concrete around us, and as we start framing out of steel, we tend to develop a ground in itself just from the mass in the array of the steel. So I'm going to say, Kelly, based on that experience, I would believe that would be a good reference point, and that would be good, not so much that it's in the concrete, but it's a mass of steel and a good reference point, and we could call that ground, because the ground is kind of a relative thing. Anyway, and I'm going to send that back to Mike. Mike, anything to add on that?
That's something you're not going to see in Article 250 of the National Electric Code, which covers grounding. But in my opinion, and Tom, you basically just said it, anything's better than nothing. You've got a mass of steel. You've got it in contact with the ground. You've got it embedded in concrete. It's similar to a UFR ground, which is the embedded ground tied into the rebar on your, you know, on your house, in your house concrete slab. So yeah, you know, it's you're not going to see it, and it's not an approved ground, but anything's better than nothing, and that's about the way I would take that.
Hey, Roger that. Kelly, if that answers your question, and before I hand it over to somebody else, if there is anything else out there, anything else out there, Kelly?
Well, it seems to me like there's a big wall with a wrought iron fence on top of it right there at the site. And if nothing else, if somebody has a ground rod and can get approval, I've got an electric jackhammer that makes driving a ground rod just a sheer delight. And we could stab one in a couple days before field day. So there, that's it. KI6IQA.
Hey, Kelly, appreciate that. Yeah, and I think there's a couple of us out there with those cool tools. Yeah, it'd just be a matter of getting permission, of course, and all that. But I do believe, in lieu of that, that pipe rail would probably be an excellent ground. You know, we have chain link fence out there. We got a lot of different things out there. So appreciate that question. That probably answered it for a lot of people out there. All righty. Well, Mike, as we move off of that, now if you're on solar, in total, just batteries, we're on 12-volt systems there. Does that eliminate a lot of the shock hazard that we have to worry about with the generators because we're not using a generator if you were set up like that way for field day?
Yeah, it certainly does, Tom. I have just below me in the garage here, I've got a 110-watt panel going to two 90-amp-hour batteries, and it's just 12 volts. So, you know, reducing it down to just the standard 12 volts, you don't have any high voltage. The shock hazard is very, very minimal. You can feel it sometimes if you have wet hands and a low resistance. But, yeah, that eliminates all of that. If we were all solar, we wouldn't really even be concerned about it. The only problem we are concerned about with 12 volts is you have a very high current device there that has safety issues that, or other issues not relating to the high voltage shock hazard.
Okay, well, I think that covers a lot of what we would have there for temp power and temporary solar and all that. So let's move ahead. Now, as we are going to be working off a generator, what's one of the primary things? We start stringing out cords. Keep in mind now, we're not on DC, we're not on 12 volts, we're on 110 volts. Primary thing when we start getting that 110 volt, 120 volt electricity off that generator, we've got all these wires kicking around there. What is one of the, well, there's actually quite a few. Dame, why don't you go ahead and name off a couple of things we'd have to watch for, such as water.
Well, as far as safety issues, we have to worry about water. We have to worry about degradation of the cords. You know, the guy that brings his cord that he's just been using with his electric lawnmower and ran over it, but it still works, one of those type of things. The other thing that, you know, maybe with us discussing safety, we don't need to get into, but we need to discuss voltage drop. The feeder coming from the generator, the long feeder coming back from the generator to the, you know, where the power connects, we've got to have a pretty decent sized wire so we don't get voltage drop and get down below our minimums on that.
Now, Roger that. Now, I guess since we're going to be running quite a few rigs, or say if we were running quite a few rigs in that circumstance, I know a rule of thumb, we start getting out 100 feet of power line cord, we used to favor number 12 wire, 312s basically, or 12-3. But how far would you guess, say, some of the lighter cords, like the number 14, number 16 orange ones that we see out there a lot? You know, how far would you think we could go with that?
Again, depending on the load, you know, 50, 75 feet is not out of the realm. But like you say, anything over 100 feet, we do have to upsize it to 12 or even 10 if possible.
And if we're all familiar out there with Ohm's Law, of course, because we would have to know that to pass, get our license. But anyway, the voltage drop is directly related to how much power we have that we're sucking out at the end over there. So if we're drawing a couple of amps, we could probably go 100 feet. If we're going to be drawing, say, 7 to 10 amps, better start looking for some heavier, you know, cable and stuff like that. So, you know, it's all relative to how much you're going to put a load on out there as to how far you're going to go. Essentially, with no load, there is no voltage drop. There's no current. So it's 110, but if you start loading that up, that wire has resistance, we get voltage dropping across that thing. Anything else to add, Mike?
Like most things, bigger is always better as far as wire size. You know, you always reduce the voltage drop as much as you can. And we will be bringing test equipment to measure that. I've got some really good load testers. I've got a lot of non-contact, four or five non-contact testers. So we will be checking the electrical safety on that, you know, periodically throughout field day.
Alrighty, switch radios again here, just adjusting the squelch there a little bit. This is KF6Q with Tech Tuesday Net on the Big Bear Amateur Radio Club repeater. Every Tuesday, conditions permitting, 1900 hours. Anyway, so let's get into that, how much load we're going to put on there. Let's say our typical rig for field day for HF is 100 watts. Now we know these aren't 100% efficient. So we're going to probably, let's just say it's 50% efficient, which means that we're going to draw 200 watts. Now, according to Ohm's Law, that would be basically divided by 120 volts, and that would give us how much current we have there. So not 2 amps, but way over 1. I don't have a calculator in front of me, but we're getting pretty close to about 1.5, 1.75 amps, maybe even 2 amps. So there's 2 amps of possibly, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 we want to pull across that cord. I have to start thinking about that. Anything to add, Mike? Back to you.
Yeah, and we have been talking about just a single generator in the past. Well, last year, that's my past. We used, I think, 3 or 4, maybe I think it was 3 or 4 generators, and so we had, I think it was 2 to 3 stations per generator. Now, if we use a single standalone, naturally we're going to have different cords running out to each of the stations and then break off from there. But yeah, it all depends on how we configure it.
Okay, Roger that. And, you know, just to retrogress a little bit here, field day, of course, started as an exercise in setting up emergency communications in the field. It's kind of been turned into a contest that kind of keeps the interest up and gets more people involved. We've got to think about these things because this is actually the things we would have to do to set up a temporary radio station, and we would definitely be concerned with how far away we get. Probably not points, of course, but anyway. As we say, possibly running off of one generator, let's look at that real quick without getting into, you know, dragging it through the mud too much. One generator worth, versus 3 or 4, I'd say one of the pros of one generator, it's all one source. One of the cons is it's all from one source. That source fails, everything goes down. Comments on that, Mike?
Well, I'm a diversity type guy. I would rather have one, the chances of all 3 or 4 generators going down versus one are a lot less. I would think that even if we do just use the one generator system, we would have backup generators just in case, and that would kind of take care of that issue.
Two words you said, assume, that's a bad one. and hoping that we would. That's another bad one. But that's one thing to think about is redundancy. What if that went down? What if this happened? What if that happened? Obviously, multiples are probably not going to go down. If we have two generators, that's redundancy. Triple is even more redundancy, which is good. Also isolates a little bit, you know, from each station. However, complicated by the fact that now we have to maintain all generators with fuel and check oil and all that. So either way, there's always complexities either way it goes. But it's one thing to think about. So one generator is great. A backup would be great, even if it would just handle one or two stations. So any questions out there or any comments on that, please come back to KF6Q.
K6YNW.
Okay, I think it's KI6YNW. I know the name is Chris. Sorry if I got the call sign wrong. Don't have my sheet in front of me. Go ahead, Chris.
Yes, I've heard so many cases where the generators aren't maintained. You know, the worst thing is to start up after a year, but apparently some of them should maybe be started every 3 weeks or something like that. K6YNW.
Yeah, that's a very good point there. You know, and I know we use generators a lot for backup and whatnot, and they'll sit around for a while. I think they call that exercising them. It's a good policy with just about anything to at least once a month. More often is better. 2 weeks would be great, but at least once a month to make sure everything stays kind of up and up and don't get any rust forming where it's not supposed to be. Here's another thing now. As far as fuel goes, if it's run off of diesel, diesel takes a long time to degrade, but not like gasoline. Gasoline, especially if it's in warm climate or hot weather, really goes bad after a while, and it won't run. So a couple things there to think about. So if you're getting ready to set up that generator and you're using gasoline in it from last year, good idea would be to drain it, unless you put some stable in there and thinking ahead. So anything on the fuel thing there, Mike?
No, I have had issues with my generator doing that. I let it sit for, it seemed like a year, but it was more. And we had to take and clean the carburetor completely out and redo it. So that is an issue. They always recommend, or at least I've heard recommendations, that unless if you have a generator that you're going to use for emergencies, just leave it empty. That way you don't have to worry about that issue. In this case, obviously, we wouldn't be able to do that. But, yeah, I have used stable, and that does extend the life of the gasoline quite a bit.
Also, it's worthwhile just running it, turn the fuel off, and let it run out. K6YNW.
Yeah, K6YNW. Actually, I was just going to add that, but that's a very good point. And like with any good point, there's a little bit of a bad side, and then, of course, then the seals will dry out and all that. But I would say to eliminate the varnish buildup in there, you're better off running them dry. Most of user manuals for like chainsaws or periodically used equipment recommend that you run it dry. Pretty much gets everything out of there, and with it sucking air through there, helps keep all the varnish off. So glad you added that, Chris. Very good point. Anybody else out there, any more comments about generators or the fuel? Okay, hearing none, I need to move into one other thing about generators out there, and that's the exhaust. Hopefully we're all outside doing this, because if that generator's running indoors, Mike, what happens with carbon monoxide and human beings?
Comment.
Go ahead, comment.
Yeah, this is W6DGP, driving through. I had a comment on your last generator. One thing you need to keep in mind, if you're using gasoline generator, when you go to refuel, you got to be careful. You're fueling a hot item. You might have it cool down a little bit to lessen the chance of a fire.
Okay, I appreciate that. And, you know, that was one thing that we wanted to touch base on everything, and it might have slipped by us, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I have personal experience of a, not so much a generator,
but it was a gasoline engine being refueled after being shut down because it ran out of gas. And all it takes is just a little bit of gas to get on that exhaust pipe. It is not much at all, or even close to that. And yes, it does. For all out there listening, it will burst into flames. This is actually bad, too, since you're holding a gas can with gas. The gas is pouring out of the gas can, and so on. So anyway, we'll get into that in just a minute. Very interesting story. Anyway, Mike, before we forget about the carbon monoxide and human beings, any common sense recommendations? Please go ahead there, WB6CLZ.
KF6Q and Tech Tuesday, WB6CLZ. Well, three words, ventilation, ventilation, ventilation. You know, carbon monoxide is odorless, tasteless, and I'm sure we've all heard this over and over again. You just kind of go to sleep and never wake up unless you're, you know, it clears itself or clears the air. Bad stuff, got to keep it ventilated. The other thing we need to do, too, as an afterthought on the previous topic is, yeah, keep the gas cans, oh, at least 10 to 20 feet away from the generator, so we don't have an issue there. Back to you, Tom.
Yeah, roger that. And like I say, with that ventilation, even if you're not in an enclosed area, you're out in the open, it's a good idea just not to be downwind. Downwind from all that exhaust fumes will definitely give you a headache, partially from that carbon monoxide. It's not going to probably kill you. It's definitely going to make you feel really bad, so stay away from the exhaust fumes if you can. Try to think about that when you're setting up equipment. If you've got a prevailing wind or of such at any time of day, and it may not be there when you're setting up, but it may be there in the afternoon. Think about that, about where equipment's set up and what it's going to do. So, anybody else out there to add on ventilation and let's just general fueling and safety with generators, please come back. KF6Q.
KE5NWI Houston.
I believe that was K5NWI. Go ahead, Houston.
One of the things that we've messed around a little bit with and I'd like to explore a little bit more is a generator feeding an inverter. And when we were powerless during the hurricane, what we did was we hooked up an inverter to one of our diesel trucks, and it powered up the entire computer system at the office. So I think that there's a good reason to start looking at what might be done about generators powering inverters powering radios. Back to you, KE5 in WI Houston, Texas.
YNW again.
Hey, thank you, Houston, Texas. We'll call you Mission Control. How's that? Hey, sorry, little joke there. Yes, Chris, go ahead.
Yes, field days and things like that where we've operated with generators, I've just had a regular battery charger and run the radio off of that. That way when the generator was shut down for refueling or whatever reason, I kept going, K6YNW.
Okay, roger that. Now, I'm assuming that you had that battery charger hooked to a battery, of course, so that way it kept the trickle charge or charged the battery continuously, which most of our radios do operate on 12 volts. Very good point there, Chris. So you're either going to have a 110-volt power supply dropping it to 12 volts or possibly a battery. So if that generator fails or runs out of gas, good point. Very good point. Appreciate that. Anybody else out there with comments like that, please come back, KF6Q.
KF6PL.
86PL. Harold, go ahead. And glad to have you with us this evening.
Now, you might want to keep some old blankets, heavy blankets, around where you have your possibility of having a fire, somebody catching on fire, so that you can smother it out rather than try to depend on a on a fire extinguisher to put it out on somebody. I set myself on fire a couple of times. I used to handle flammables, and a couple of times I set myself on fire, and that was the way I got out of it. So I grabbed some blankets and rolled up in them.
That's an excellent safety thought, you know, just in case, because we have to, that just in case is possibly could happen, hopefully not, but you need to be prepared for that. Good thing, too, I also have maybe a little 5-pound fire extinguisher on hand, good safety issue there, you know, when there's any flammables, and a blanket does not hurt. Good point there, Harold. Appreciate that. Thanks for that experience, and hopefully you weren't barbecued too bad there, buddy, so... All right, anybody else out there with any comments on that or safety items with the generators and all this fuel and things happening in the field? Please come back, KF6Q. All right, well, I think we've covered quite a few different things on generators, and if there's anybody out there who happens to think of something further on down the line this evening, please feel free to jump in and add that. We'd rather share that stuff with everybody out there than just say, hey, well, I'm too late, I missed it. So if somebody out there comes up with something, jump in there anytime. Anyway, Mike, going moving on to other items we have out there at the field day. Well, we have power. We have power to the radio. Out of the radio, it goes to an antenna. Aha, antennas. Antennas don't work well sitting on the ground, so we generally put them up in the air. Extension ladders, trees, poles, whatever. What would be, just thinking of power and power lines, give us some tips there on what to watch for overhead. WB6 CLZ, KF6Q.
KF6Q, WB6 CLZ, Tech Tuesday. Well, luckily, at the site we have out there at Bear Mountain, there, to my knowledge, in the area, there are no power lines. So for us, that's a good thing. But, you know, other people may be out in parks, maybe out in other areas where there are. And, you know, anything that you contact with power line has a potential of electrocution. So we've always got to watch out for overhead lines. I don't even care if they're communication lines, you know, like telephone or cable. You still have a potential there, and you really don't know what's running through those things. So you've always got to watch out for overhead lines when you're putting up vertical or especially any sort of an antenna up in the air. That's the main factor. Keep your eyes open and make sure that there's no wires overhead.
Okay, Mike, appreciate that. Yeah, I know a lot of areas have got everything underground. Some of the older areas do not. I know down there in Mira Loma, where I used to live, half the town is underground feeds, and the other older parts are overhead. So you got to be very careful about that, obviously, for that reason. And electrocution, yes, very bad thing. Very bad thing to happen out there. We don't want to see that happen to anybody out there. Well, now, if we're putting up these ladders and temporary towers and poles and things, trying to think, if we have winds that come up, we got to be kind of careful about that. So we want to make sure they're tied down, strapped down, guide down to some way, shape, or form. Because once again, that wind may not be there while you're putting things up. Later on that day, you've got a huge sail in the sky. Mike, have you got any comments on that and any experiences? Please go ahead.
I've been kind of fortunate because generally when I hear of a weather report that we're going to get heavy winds, I bring everything down. I nest everything, and we don't have issues like that. But, yeah, it's definitely a potential, especially up here in the mountains. We can get some pretty heavy winds that come up just out of nowhere. This time of the year when we have the low pressures come through, we have the marine layer down there, we can get some pretty decent winds in the afternoons. And that is an issue. Make sure everything is tied down well. Where you can, make sure they're guide. You know, at least on two different at two different points, and preferably three or four. But yeah, that's about all I can think of right offhand. Back to you, Tom.
Hey, Yeah, this is KF6Q on the Big Bear Amateur Radio Club repeater, Tech Tuesday at 1900 hours every Tuesday, conditions permitting. Well, that's true. I'd say that one guy line that's opposing the prevailing wind is better than nothing at all, but barely. Two is better. Three is great. And four is fantastic. Anything more than that, you're wasting rope. So, speaking of winds, I don't know if we have one of our listeners down there in Lucerne Valley, KA6CIA. George, are you out there with us this evening?
K6BB.
Okay, George, don't hear George out there. Let's see, usually have somebody else out there who's kind of familiar with Lucerne. W6KMM. Kenneth, are you out there? Nothing heard from either one. Well, anyway, anybody out there who's ever been in the desert knows it is windy almost all the time. And the winds get very, very high out there. If you're down in some of the pass areas, you know that the winds are going to be kind of predominant from one direction. So all of these things, you have to be very careful setting up with your towers and your antennas. Here again, too, as we set these antennas up, maybe your tower's fine. Keep in mind where that antenna wire is. If it's got a whole bunch of antlers, a lot of aluminum up there, when that starts to tip over, should it tip over, are those antlers going to hit a power line where maybe even the tower never would? So the other thing is safety. Mike, when we're putting up towers or maybe we're working on a ladder overhead securing something, what's a good idea for somebody who's working underneath the person overhead? Go ahead, Mike. WB6CLZ, KF6Q.
Oh, yeah. If I was working underneath somebody, especially some of these klutzy guys that are in the club, no, not really. I'm the klutzy guy. Yeah, I would kind of wish I had a hard hat on. I think that would be a very, very good idea to have some sort of a decent hard hat, because you never know. The guy up above you might be... I work in a boom truck all the time, and Cindy is my ground person, my wife. And, you know, you never know when someone is going to drop a wrench or something, and... I'll tell you, that can be lethal from 10, 20, 30, 40, you probably wouldn't be 40, but 10, 20, 25 feet up, you know, that can take you out. You can go to Never Never Land with that kind of stuff. Very careful. Hard hats, very importante.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of construction sites, whatever, it's mandatory for that reason. And that's if you don't have a hard hat, if you don't have any protection, it would be very wise to simply just stand back. If somebody's working overhead, don't watch them from directly below them. That is not what you do. You want to stand back, and unless you're going to actually hand them something, or if you do, get out of the way. Stay out of the way. That's in lieu of not having the proper equipment. And I would say that's even a good thing to do, even if you have a hard hat on. There's no sense of being underneath there asking for something to take out a shoulder, a forearm. It may not kill you, but sure is going to hurt. And you may break something there, too. So very good point there. Not mandatory, but good common sense. And a lot of hard hats can be had at any of your local, I'm going to call it the builder's supermarket. So anyway, Mike, another little thing, too, we want to get into is safety vests. And... why we even wear them. Let me reset. Yellow, fluorescent yellow, green, and orange fluorescent safety vests are really being used a lot more and actually being required by a lot of construction site insurance carriers. And the reason for it is this. You don one of those on, and all of a sudden you stand out like a sore thumb. Otherwise, you could possibly blend in. Somebody doesn't see you over there. You're spinning around with a ladder. Maybe it didn't hurt you a lot, but it just took you out. This is an optional thing, but it's a good thing to say, hey, well, there he is. And if you're the only guy there with a vest on, they'll find you. You will stick out. Mike, any comments on that?
Tom, Cindy's chuckling in the background. As I say, she's my ground person when we're out working the boom truck doing our electrical jobs, and she loves her vest. Her vest and her cones. Anyway, and I mean the yellow cones, or the orange cones that she puts out. Anyway, yeah, hard hat, safety vest, very good idea. One thing we should probably talk about, too, is safety glasses. You know, you look up and you're vulnerable. I've done that here. I've cranked up the pole tower, and I have a disc cone antenna. If anybody knows how a disc cone antenna is configured, it's got radials on it. Well, I have had more than once I have cranked that up, and the vibration of cranking up the tower caused the radials to dislodge and come sailing down. In one instance especially, had I been looking up at that antenna going up, I probably would have lost an eye, or, you know, at least had a radial poking in my face. Then when you guys see me at the club meetings, I would have a big hole in my face. So safety glass is another important thing to talk about.
Hey, Mike, I'm assuming that it probably just hit your head, which is so hard, it just glanced off and hopefully didn't hurt the radio, so a little joke here, sorry. Anyway, yeah, it's a good point there. Like I say, the safety vest, if you pan the area with, you know, you're working on something and you just, you know, people now stand out, especially if you're coworkers or people helping you there. You know, it sounds silly that not being able to spot the forest for the trees, but you know, that just makes you stand out to everybody around. If you have vehicles in the area delivering anything, whether they're delivering generators or bringing in supplies or setting up tents and bringing things in of that nature, if you have that vest on, all of a sudden you're on display right there. Good chance that they're going to say, oh, wow, I almost ran over that guy, but I saw that vest. And that's not a joke. Very, very, very good. Easily could happen. Without having that on. So I'll need a reset. So besides that, and having some good support shoes or whatever is another thing here. Besides eyeglasses, Mike, protecting your eyes, shoes. You're going to be working around stuff like this setting up. Not really critical once you're running the radios, but wear some good foot protection, too, in case something drops that your floppers didn't just leave your toes exposed there and it took out a nail or a toe. So always good, well, at least while you're setting stuff up, dress accordingly, you know, and, you know, when it's all done and said with, you know, you can kick back in your Bermudas and your tank top and with a Pepsi, and that's different. But while you're setting up stuff, very serious things there to deal with. So anyway, any comments on the last few things there? Going to leave a little room here for comments, people, questions, suggestions, anything. Please come back to KF6Q Tech Tuesday.
Okay, Y and W again.
Yeah, Y and W. Chris, go ahead.
Up in the high desert, this woman was a teacher, taught drama. And she was on a scaffolding about 7 feet above the floor, and she forgot she was in the scaffolding, just turned around, fell to the concrete below. She's in a wheelchair now. That can easily happen when we're standing on a scaffolding for a ham radio or a tower or something like that. K6YNW.
Exactly. Very good point there, Chris. Yeah, if you're not used to being on equipment like that, all of a sudden you realize that you're not as high as you were before, can cause serious injury. And, yeah, in 6 feet, 7 feet, or less, you can actually get seriously injured depending on how you fall, or be very lucky and not get a scratch. But with stuff like that, also as you're setting up any of these ladders or towers that are going to be set up temporary or lashed down or guide off, whatever, make sure, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that all of those guy lines are secure, that the stakes they're tied to are secure. Make sure all that's solid. You start climbing up on something and that thing was just barely into the ground, the thing falls over and you get to ride it down to the ground. Hopefully you don't get hurt, but people have in the past. So that's another little thing there. Remember, best thing is don't climb up there if you don't need to. Try to get everything up ahead of time. Once again, any other comments out there? And just want to add that into what Chris said. Please come back to KF6Q.
W6DGP.
Yeah, go ahead. KF6Q here, Check Tuesday.
One thing that we've run across that helps us is we mark our guide wires so that people can see them. They don't run into them either personally or with a vehicle.
Yeah, Roger that. That's another thing, too. We have done that in the past over there where we set up, but that's very good to be brought out right now. A very inexpensive roll of fluorescent orange tape or anything of that nature, or even white. Something is better than nothing. Fluorescent orange is great. It is very easy to be walking along. You don't see the guy wire, and you get seriously injured depending on what height it comes across your body. So, good point. Thank you very much for bringing that up. Anybody else out there, any good suggestions or experiences out there, please come back to KF6Q.
D6PL
Harold. We call you Barbecue Harold. Anyway, go ahead.
When you're expecting it, you never get a nerve or panic. That's the thing. If you get on fire, somebody else gets on fire, you panic, you're going to fry. As long as you keep your cool and make sure you smother the fire. But one other thing that most people just take for granted, and I see them doing really, really stupid things continuously, not with ham radio, I see that too, but occasionally, usually just around their cars, is that little lead acid battery sitting there. That thing is a major piece of high explosive material. It's more potent than a stick of dynamite. I put one up in my face one night, so I found out the hard way. Major flashlight and a huge bang. People in the restaurant where I was at thought that somebody had set a bomb off outside the place. And what I did, I was cold, it was raining, middle of the night, and I got in a hurry with a set of jumper cables. And I slapped the ground on first, and I just started to put the plus on, and the little spark jump. I saw it jump, and I knew then it was a mistake, but too late. That hydrogen gas blew up in my face. The entire battery case on the hull. So you want to make sure you know how to handle that stuff. It's not a very good idea to put those things in your house for any reason whatsoever. Even in your garage is not a good idea because you could end up accidentally blowing it up and burning your house down. AD6PL.
Okay, Harold, that's some very, very good information there about batteries and the explosive nature of such. And keep in mind, too, especially if you're dealing with a deep cycle or not a deep cycle, a battery that would, say, go into a vehicle that's going to have a lot of power to it, if you get a short across those terminals, it is a huge spark when it's shorted out. Incredible spark. I mean, it'll melt the screwdriver. Do not know that from experience, by the way, but I'm sure some people out there have had something like that happen. So you'll be very careful about that flash. Besides startling you, it could also ignite something else nearby the battery. So all that to be careful about. As we're outside setting all this gear up and doing all these things for field day, one very important thing to take care of is yourself. Make sure you have some water out there with you. Keep hydrated. As we start getting into the warmer weather, get out in the sun. Sunstroke, very easy to happen. Wear a hat, wear a little sunblock, and keep some water with you. A couple of water bottles, because I'll guarantee you, it'll happen. Once it happens, next thing you know, you are really sick, and they're hauling you off. So, anything else to add from anybody else out there, please come back. KF6Q. Okay, Raj, that. So, yeah, that's taking care of yourself in these conditions, with, like I say, if you have wind. If you've got really bad conditions, of course, you want to have a jacket and any kind of protection like that. Normally by the last weekend in June, not to be worried about, but other than the sun with sunblock. Now, if you are setting up mobile or something like this in the future for a true emergency condition, make sure you can take care of yourself also more than just getting the equipment set up. The equipment won't do any good without an operator, and that would be you. So, anyway, Mike, we've only covered just the surface of a few things here. Anything else you could think of to add to safety on Tech Tuesday setup? WB6CLZ, KF6Q.
The only thing I can think of right offhand, KF6Q, WB6CLZ with Tech Tuesday, a safety observer. Have a guy or a lady, you know, that kind of knows what they're doing, you know, independent, not doing the work, if you have the manpower, to kind of stand by the sidelines and watch what's going on and make sure everything's safe. That is always a good thing if you have and if you have the manpower. That's about it. I'm sure we can come up with a whole heck of a lot. But I sure am looking forward to Field Day. That is a heck of a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll have a lot of people coming and operating and enjoying the heck out of themselves. And, you know, guys, if you have a tech license and want to experience HF, you can do that at Field Day. There'll be higher-class licensees there, so you can kind of enjoy HF and see what it's like to kind of entice you into upgrading. Hey, back to you, Tom.
Yeah, Roger, that. A couple other things there. Any of the hams out there listening, you do not have to be a member of the Big Bear Amateur Radio Club. We will be setting up here at Bear Mountain in the parking lot. We have been there the last 2 years. It's a great site. You can't miss us. It's a bunch of geeky people running around talking on radios, and you'll see the antennas and whatnot. And if you're in the area for the weekend, please stop by. We'd be more than happy to share the radio or have you visit and see what's going on. You know, it's fantastic. And like Mike said, tech class, and you can operate. Actually, third party can, with the GoTo station, get on the air. Don't know if we're going to have that set up this year, but you know, either way, you know, bring your friends out. Show them what this is all about. You know, and it's pretty neat. It's a good effort. So, anything else out there anybody would like to add, please come back. KF6Q.
Okay, YNW again.
Yes, Chris, go ahead, YNW.
Yep. In operations that are often done by the national standards now because insurance pays, but anyway, the safety officer is a person who stands aside, and that safety officer, aside from maybe the head honchos, can shut everything down. So, yeah, important person, K6YNW.
A very good point there. And I would think it would be a good idea for the safety officer, if you do not have enough people available, if it's a club function, that person be the person in charge. Arguments can start with whose idea we're going to use for what. Either way, if there is a question, not a fight or dispute, but just of what should be done, it's a good idea to have one person out there that you can just say, well, that person, whatever that person says, hopefully knowledgeable person about safety and all that, whatever they say goes. So if and hopefully that directs everybody in the right direction, eliminates any controversy and gets it done quickly and in a safe manner. Anybody else out there, any comments or suggestions, please come back to KF6Q. All right, well, we're almost at an hour here, Mike. WB6CLZ, appreciate you joining in, and everybody else out there. I know we have a lot of listeners out there. Like I said, I was just running a little bit behind today. Actually, it was that 10 freeway was stopped, you know, so I had no control over that. So anyway, as traffic is unpredictable as the weather, as they say. Anyway, appreciate everybody listening and participating. And as we are approaching Field Day, there are a few more things we may cover next week, just things that have added. So if anybody out there discovers anything else they'd like to share, there's many other things we're going to bring up, too, as far as setup and provisions on food and everything under the sun. Propane bottles, oh, the favorite, and safety procedures with that. So, good to have everybody out there. This is KF6Q closing the net at 1900 hours and 58 minutes. And appreciate everybody out there. Please join in again next Tuesday on Tech Tuesday here, 1900 hours. KF6Q returning the repeater back to normal use.